now let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, my break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, yeah, I got the semi four way. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and tried to locate. This for the time, got time for no day war.
Welcome to another episode of the Chronos Podcast, presented by OPW Commercial Services. We've got a special one today. I am joined by the legendary Lee Steinberg. Lee, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. I've heard all about Crow Nose.
Well, fitting, the branding being the old school Bo Jackson, Bo Nose fits right into your wheelhouse. I want to start off, everybody talks about unbeatable records in sports. And I would argue that your record for most number one overall picks represented is the pinnacle that will never be broken. How do you, at this, you know, point in your career, look back on a record like that? What does that mean?
Well, it's really about the individual one-on-one relationships. And I think the most critical skill in life is listening. If you can create enough trust and stillness around another human being to get them to open up and peel back the layer of the onion so that you get more and more into their core. You can understand someone else's deepest anxieties and fears and their greatest hopes and dreams. And if you can put yourself in the other person's heart and mind and see the world the way they see it, you can navigate your way through. So whether it's 8 first overall picks in the draft, whether it's the 50 baseball first round picks we did, it's all a series of relationships and personally being bonded with someone.
It's an incredible record, incredible number. And you know, once you get a couple in, and then it's obviously you've got the credibility and everything, but take me back to the first, you know, the first overall pick, that early part of your career. How do you get across that credibility that, you know, even though you haven't done this specific thing before, that you've got the chops to do it, you know you can do it, and then getting that trust?
So there really was no field of sports agentry when I was going undergrad and law school. It was very embryonic. I was a dorm counselor in an undergraduate dorm working my way through law school. And they moved the freshman football team into the dorm, and one of the students was the quarterback, Steve Bartkowski. And in January of 1975, he became the first overall pick in the NFL draft. So I had known him from the dorm, and I'm coming out of law school, and I'm probably going to go to work for the Alameda County DA's office. I wanted to be in the courtroom. But before I ever got there, Bartkowski asked me to represent him. And there I was, AJ, brimming with legal experience, never having had a client before. But we had a World Football League competing against the NFL, and did the largest rookie contract of all time. So the question then was, would I continue to do this? And I'd been raised by a father who stressed 2 core values. One was treasure relationships, especially family. And the second was to try to make a meaningful difference in the world and help people who couldn't help themselves. So I was looking for that. And I saw in that first experience how the athletes are the movie stars, the athletes are the celebrities. And I thought, well, you know, if they would go back and retrace their roots to the high school, collegiate, professional community, set up a scholarship fund at the high school, or work with a church or a boys and girls club, if they'd go to the college and bond with the alums, if they would set up a charitable foundation in which they attack some cause critical to them and have the leading business figures, political figures, and community leaders on a board, then they could execute a program. So that's running back Warwick Dunn, who put the 200th single mother and her family into the first home we'll ever own. And that was 51 years ago.
The sports agency world specifically, and sports in general, most people think of it as a very dog-eat-dog world, and it's, you know, sharky, and maintaining the relationship specifically with, obviously, your background and your experience, You mentioned the philanthropic aspect of it, being very focused on doing things the right way. How did that go as you're, you know, coming up in your career, maintaining that level of passion about that and wanting to do things the right way when most people around you or a lot of people around you are very opposite in their approach and it's very, you know, more selfish, more, you know, shark, like I said?
So I thought it was necessary to reimagine what agency and representing someone meant. It was about understanding their core values. Could I understand how someone felt about short-term economic gain, long-term economic security, spiritual values, family, geographical location, profile, and then for an athlete, being a starter, being on a winning team, and understanding that, and then thinking about how to make them a role model, thinking about how to lay the foundation and the seeds for second career from the beginning so they would smoothly integrate into that. And it also meant thinking about the health and long-term welfare of an athlete, because they tend to be in a state of denial when it comes to trying to protect themselves. So it was necessary to reimagine what that relationship could be and not simply stacking dollars into someone's bank book.
Did you have any moment, like you mentioned, it was embryonic. The structure, the agency model didn't really exist before you came along. Was there one specific time that you were able to take a step back and say, wow, I've really created something here? Or is it more, you know, you just don't even really realize it until you get a little further down the road?
Not really. There was never time for reflection, because there's always time to meet the next athlete and do the next deal. And before I knew it, 50 years at best.
Was there, once was obviously, you know, everyone always says it was remember the first time, but was there ever a deal that maybe it was a player that, you know, you weren't sure would really connect with your message, that you wound up coming together and working with? Or was there a specific deal that you look back on? I'm sure there's plenty, but a specific deal that you look back on and think, wow, that's something I'm really proud of.
So in 1984, Warren Moon came back from Canada, where he'd spent 6 years, to the NFL. And he came back as a pure free agent. And at that time, there were not prominent black quarterbacks, middle linebackers, or so-called thinking positions. There was a certain level of skepticism. And he broke that and became the first African-American quarterback in modern history to be inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And so that was the biggest deal ever. But then Steve Young, a quarterback coming out of BYU, was the beneficiary of a new league, the USFL. And he did a contract that made headlines all around the world. And it was, wait for it, AJ, $42 million. And Dan Rather led off the CBS News with that contract. So that year was sort of a breakthrough.
It's funny hearing back and reading the old press clippings about, you know, it was always the first $1 million salary that was, how is this going to be sustainable? As you were developing in your career, were there any of those points that you hit with, whether it be contracts or, you know, the way things were being done? A lot of people go to the NFL, the draft, to, you know, how rookie salaries got, I think maybe Sam Bradford was the last one where it was the $50, $60 million guaranteed. Were there any of those things when you were, as your career was progressing, that you thought, this seems kind of unsustainable?
Absolutely. So I went to owners and said, we're conceptualizing this whole thing wrong, because instead of having ugly public negotiations over a draft pick or a veteran that push away fans, we should be keeping that business low-key. Instead of collective bargaining that pitted millionaires against billionaires, we should be doing those things very easily behind the scenes. And the battle in sports, Mr. Owner, is not labor versus management. Properly conceived, it's the battle against every other form of discretionary entertainment spending. The competition is Major League Baseball and home box office and Netflix and Walt Disney World and every other way that people spend money for entertainment. So what we ought to be about, because I've got the big stars of your team, we ought to be in partnership. We ought to be thinking about how do we do an exponentially bigger TV contract? How do we do new stadia with jumbo scoreboards and naming rights and ancillary revenue streams? How do we do fantasy sports? How do we use the internet? And if we can grow a pie that's substantially larger, there'll be plenty for everyone.
I think one of the most fascinating things about your industry is, and a lot of people in business are listening to this podcast, and a lot of people think, well, you know, if something doesn't work out, there's always more customers, right? There's always more buyers. In your case, in NFL, obviously it's changed throughout the years, but there's 32 teams and there's 32 GMs. And so you have to, at the same time, balance what's right for your player, your side, with negotiating against one of only 32. You know, and obviously you have a couple more, but how do you go about navigating that relationship where you've got to still maintain a great relationship for the next one?
You have a great insight there, because the truth of the matter is you will deal in professional sports with the same people over and over and over again. So you have to find a win-win philosophy where you're able to maximize your players' compensation, but at the same time fulfilling the team's need. Again, if you can put your head into that of the general manager or the owner and understand how to craft that, you'll be dealing with the same person repetitively. So deals are made on a handshake, and you need to never violate that trust. The key is keeping negotiations in perspective, keeping the ultimate goal of an owner in perspective. If I can do that and balance it, then that's the magic elixir.
Trust is obviously the biggest thing in earning that, and that relationship you've mentioned a lot so far. I'm sure there's times where you've had to say, hey, I don't think this is the right partnership, or I don't think this is the right fit. And I think a lot of people struggle in that, no matter what business they're in, is, you know, everybody wants, you know, everyone wants to grow, wants more customers, but inevitably you're faced with a time where, you know, it's not the right fit. So talk a little bit about how you navigated those situations with somebody that, you know, you really didn't see eye to eye with. They may have wanted to work with you, but you didn't think it was the right fit.
Concept negotiation is creating a vivid panorama of what's relevant in the world. The real question is, whose reality is going to prevail? Whose concept of what are relevant metrics is going to win the day? And so instead of just saying, I want more money, what you can do is look at comparables, look at profitability, and lay out a well-reasoned argument and a well-reasoned view of what is fair. There's no arbitrator. There's no judge that says that's the right number. The only place you see that is in baseball arbitration. So it's all a matter of putting together a convincing argument about why compensation should be at a certain level.
Going into baseball, you mentioned obviously, you know, started in football, got into baseball, tremendous success there. I think a lot of business owners, business leaders, they think, you know, do we stay in our lane or do we branch out and go into something new? Talk about how you guys made that decision to start representing in baseball and every other sport known to man that you guys are in as well.
Well, I grew up loving baseball. The Dodgers came to Los Angeles in the late 50s and Sandy Koufax and Maury Wills, and I may have my business, but I'm just a fan when it comes to things like the Dodgers. So we started years and years ago. I had a player back in the mid-70s named Carney Lansford who won the American League batting championship. And then we followed that with players like Will Clark and Pudge Rodriguez who were here with the Rangers. And we ended up with about 50 players, CC Sabathia, Manny Ramirez, Sean Green. The basic principles are all the same. And from there, we moved into basketball, where I had four lottery picks and did boxing with Lennox Lewis and Oscar De La Hoya. The U.S. men's soccer team in the World Cup in 1994, and it just kept expanding and expanding because the principles were pretty much the same, which is having a realistic sense of who your athlete was. The methodology has changed so that when I began, you had rotary phones and and electric typewriters, and if you were on the phone and someone called you, it rang busy. And so that's changed. Now we have the multiple platforms of content supply, and people seem addicted to their cell phones. But the principles in terms of trying to get into the head of an athlete, understanding who they are uniquely, not generically, is still the same.
Was there any, and I don't think learning curve is the right word, but going into a different sport, negotiating with, you know, new set of executives, new sets of teams, new sets of owners, like human nature is, even though it is probably very similar, human nature is, well, you know, you don't know our sport. Our sport's different. Was there any of those situations that you guys faced going into those new sports where you had to overcome some of those, hey, you know, we know it's different, but it's not that different?
So the definition of a great sports agent is someone who has very talented clients. And so it helped to enter each of those fields with the batting champion of the American League, the heavyweight champion of the world, a lottery pick. But the first key is research. So you need to understand the economics of baseball, and you need to understand where the revenue comes from, what TV is like, what gate is like, and you need to understand the game itself and what skill set makes someone a tremendous athlete. And it became clear after years that an athlete who had self-discipline, an athlete who had a pristine work ethic, an athlete that was able to function in critical moments and to elevate their level of play was going to be a winner. And that was the same concept in every sport. But you needed to research so you could talk baseball just like a general manager could.
You mentioned the Dodgers, being a big fan growing up. You mentioned economics of baseball being a little bit different, obviously, than salary cap in NFL, NBA. Now, Dodgers specifically, the deferred compensation piece is a big topic right now with Ohtani's deal and a lot of the deals that the Dodgers have done. You know, some people say, is it fair, is it not fair? At the end of the day, everyone agrees on something and it's within the rules. But for something like that, which I think is really interesting, you talked a lot about long-term gain. If you have a client that comes to you and says, hey, I'm open to deferring all this money out into the future, but maybe you don't think, hey, this might not be the right idea. How do you navigate those kinds of situations when a player actually wants to do something that's great for the team but may not be great for them?
The definition of what's great for them ultimately has to be their judgment. It ultimately needs to be their decision. And if you've properly educated an athlete so they understand the nature of what the market is and what their perceived value is and the rest of it, and they make a decision that they would rather be part of a winning team, and that for the Super Bowl quarterback to get to the Super Bowl, to win that, puts him into the category of a household name and probably garners $30-40 million worth of endorsements. But for someone who wants to have a quarterback, wants to have the right left tackle in front of him, wants to not get eviscerated with every sack, they can make that decision. And the world can critique it, but agents are a particularly critical bunch anyway. So if I brought home a $2 trillion contract for 1 year, there would be agents who would say, that wasn't enough money. He didn't get, or he was lucky, or it wasn't structured right. So again, at the end of the day, you're working for a client, and satisfying that person is the nexus of the relationship.
How tough is it managing, a lot of times you've got different players on the same team, different players at similar positions, and you want every player to think they're the best and to feel confident that they're the best, but not every deal is going to be different. And I'm sure there's things that, it's obviously private between you and that client, but then has there ever been times where another player that you represent will come to you or that you hear about and say, hey, what happened here? Like, why did he get more? Why did she get more? Or what's the story behind this? And there's things that you can't tell, but how do you navigate those kind of situations?
So the critical key in this is to educate that client.
Yeah.
And you have to be, I don't make the decisions about who starts and how much playing time they get. And ultimately, I can have input, but can't shape the perception that a front office or a coach has of how valuable a player is. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the question is, are you replaceable or not? Are you irreplaceable, non-fungible, non-modular? Do you have options? And so it's having that sense. So the key at the top of the pyramid in every athletic deal are going to be those people you can't replace. So on a football team, it's because of the advent of free agency in the modern passing game, it's the left tackle that protects the quarterback's blind side. It's always the quarterback. It's an edge rusher. And certain positions have more value. So I can't forge the difference between whether a running back who's invaluable should be compensated like the quarterback. That's just tradition in the sport. Or that the utility infielder should be paid what the home run hitter is getting. That's predetermined by outside forces. All I can control is maximizing player by player and fulfilling them. And they make different decisions. Tim McDonald, who was a progenitor of the Show Me the Money line in Jerry Maguire, had a free agency decision to make. And I asked him what his key values were. And he said, well, I want to go somewhere that I can win because we've never won. And I come from Fresno, California. I'd like to be closer to my family. So there's 5 or 10 teams that come into the mix. Now the 49ers express interest. And they're a winning team, and they're the closest city to Fresno. And instead of saying bid all these alternative teams off against each other and get the most money you can, he said, get me the best deal you can from the 49ers. Because he knew at the end of the day, he'd be close to home and he'd be a winner, and therefore that's how he defined happiness.
You mentioned a couple things within there, not only the advent of, the NFL and the passing game and how things have changed there, and free agency specifically. I think we're in, I don't even know what you would call the current NIL structure within the college world.
Chaos.
Chaos. From your perspective, just as you saw this unraveling, but this is obviously, it's coming down the pipe. It happens pretty quickly, and then we're kind of sorting through everything right now. From your perspective, how did you feel as this was getting rolled out, and then how has that evolved in your eyes?
So for years and years, we pleaded with the NCAA to take collegiate athletes who came from challenged economic circumstances and give them a little more money to equalize their non-athletic peers. So if you're not an athlete, you can work to cover your expenses, but if you are, you can't work. So it left athletes from disadvantaged homes at a disadvantage. Mm. What happened was that in order to fix that, the NCAA kept resisting. And along comes NIL. It was intended as a supplement to player revenue. What it's become is a revolution in which it collectives formed at every major college and decided to use money as the tool in high school and college recruiting. So the best quarterback in this year's class out of high school committed to LSU. He got allegedly $4 million. All of a sudden, someone at Michigan, a big alum, comes along and offered him $14 million, and he decommitted to LSU and transferred. The second shot is the transfer portal. And so the quarterback at Tennessee, Amaliva, sat out from spring ball like he was a pro holdout because he didn't like his NIL deal. He goes in a transfer portal and he transfers to UCLA. UCLA's second quarterback transfers to Tennessee. <Yeah. laughs> So what you're going to see is the elevation of four conferences. The four major conferences have so much resource in the way of resources, have so many alums willing to give them money, have such great business opportunities that they will sign all the great players. And if they can't get them out of high school, they'll poach them out of another college. So they'll elevate and pull away. The effect it'll have on women's sports, non-revenue generating sports, is we'll see. But it's become a complete money game. Moreover, it starts at an earlier age. Mm-hmm. So can you imagine a 15-year-old high school quarterback is looking for a marketing director to start doing endorsements, and he's putting together a website and branding himself and all the rest of it. Well, our practice rests on the ability to find mature young men or women with mature parents that can accept role modeling, second career, all these concepts. Good luck at 15.
You mentioned Nico and the parents there at the end, and that was part of it. And there's always been throughout, you know, as long as college and pro sports have been around, there's always the, you know, talk about who was working the back channels and the family member and things like that. Have you guys seen a difference in the players that are coming out? Because I know there's a lot of negative, obviously, associated with it, but I've always thought, well, is there a positive that players are more used to having the money, and so they're not as many horror stories maybe that you hear into the pro world? But are you seeing any difference, whether it be positive or negative, from players coming into the draft?
What you might see is a player who'd be tempted to come out early for economic need.
Right.
So that basically every great player in college ball comes out of school after their third year, their junior year. You might see someone who would sit in school longer, or maybe a one-and-done basketball player is not one-and-done. He spends more time there. So that could be a positive. You raise the issue of not handling money well. That's a matter of having the right financial planner from the beginning. And athletes whose parents are involved in the process of picking an agent or a financial planner do very, very well. And they get a financial plan, they get an understanding of the necessity of budgeting, they understand that they won't be at this rate of revenue for 50 years, and they do quite well and they come out of sports independently wealthy. But those athletes that don't have parental involvement may sign with someone unethical who, for example, will sign them to power of attorney and be able to dip directly into the athlete's bank book.
I want to talk a little bit about things like Agent Academy and specifically how you're obviously running your business. It's been wildly successful, but they also have this other aspect that's giving back to the community, the world that you built. Talk a little bit about Agent Academy first, and then also how you juggle both of those worlds of allocating enough time, obviously, to both of them.
So at the end of the day, I judge myself by was I able to address societal issues through the power of athletes. When we saw pain, were we willing to go after it? Could we get athletes to talk to high school players about the concept of bullying? And could we get the high school players to be the promoters of tolerance? Could they put their arm around a little girl who has a hair lip? And you could change the culture of that school really quickly. But whether it's sex trafficking or domestic violence or racism, it's addressing those problems, and there are ways to do that all. I wanted to create and mentor a new generation of sports professionals. They don't have to be agents. They can work for a team, a league, a conference, an athletic department, sports marketing, branding. But could we create a next generation with values and ethics who understood the skills necessary to make it in the world? So you go to business school or law school or sports marketing as a major, and they teach you the principles of the field. What they don't teach you are the skills. So how to sell, how to recruit. So we do those exercises at the Agent Academy. How to negotiate. And I wrote a book, Winning with Integrity, how to get what you want without losing your soul. How to brand and market an athlete. How to set up a charitable foundation, how to do damage control. So we bring people together, and we've done it here in town at SMU a couple times. Well, I've also held sports career conferences where we have people in media and people in front offices and people. But it's mentoring, sharing, giving inspiration to that next generation.
The philanthropy piece and give back, it's obviously, you mentioned, you know, Winning with Integrity. That's really the linchpin of your career and foundation. And I want you to talk a little bit about the new foundation and the work you guys are doing in concussions, and then some of the other things we talked about off camera with some of these health advances that are really exciting.
So I had a crisis of conscience back in the 1980s because I was representing half the starting quarterbacks in the NFL. And they kept getting hit in the head. And we would go to neurologists and doctors and ask, how many is too many? What's the magic number? When should we contemplate retirement? They had no answers. So I held the first concussion conference back in 1994. And I thought, you know, my responsibility has to be more than just stacking dollars into a bank book. It has to be the long-term health of a player, and what did it matter if I enriched someone and they got dementia at the end of their career? The first one had Troy Aikman and Steve Young and Warren Moon and Drew Bledsoe and Rob Johnson all came to talk, to listen to neurologists. By 2006, we finally had some metrics, and Bennett Amalu, who the concussion movie was about, told us that three or more is the magic number. And after that, you have an exponentially higher rate of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, premature senility, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and depression. So I called it a ticking time bomb and an undiagnosed health epidemic. And we kept holding those conferences over the years. And I throw a little tiny Super Bowl party every year. And we had a brain health summit every year. So I thought maybe we could put a foundation together that would raise awareness about what the dangers are, raise funds for finding cure, raise, and then help at-risk communities. So we've got a plan to help the LA firefighters who were traumatized in that tragedy. We've got plans to help a underserved community like the homeless, or to help kids in the inner city, giving them specific brain treatment. And we found a couple techniques that can actually rehabilitate through the concept of neuroplasticity, a traumatic brain injury, TBI brain, One of them is called RTMS, and the other is called neurofeedback. And so if you're interested, because we can use volunteers, you can go to leesteinbergfoundation.org.
It's incredible, and the Flint, I think I've read close to $1 billion from your clients have gone to charity and money that's been raised. I would assume that's probably one of the things that you're most proud of in your career is being able to make that kind of impact and get your clients in there. Are there any good stories that you can think of? Either somebody that, you know, maybe came from a world where that wasn't even on the radar to set up these kind of foundations, or somebody that's really taken off. You mentioned Work Done, obviously, is, you know, one of the most famous in terms of that. But any of those, you know, great stories?
So Warren Moon came from a single parent family in West Los Angeles. And there were all sorts of barriers to him ever making it. He set up something called the Crescent Moon Foundation when he was in Houston, and continued it for the 23 years that he played. And what it did is it took high school kids and gave them scholarships so they could go to college. One night I was at a banquet, and the recipients of the Warren Moon scholarships were all there, and he asked them to stand up. And he looked around the room one by one. It was awe-inspiring. And one young man walked up to me and said, "You know, I'm a doctor, but I never could have gone to college without this scholarship." He said, "God bless Warren Moon." So it's a matter of those sorts of programs. Currently, Patrick Mahomes has his 15 and the Mahomies. So they take kids and buy them school lunches. They take kids in hospitals and make their life more supported. They take kids from terrible circumstances and help them. So it's a vision of how each person can make a difference. You know, my father used to say to me, there's a tendency when you see a problem in the world, as small as picking up a piece of paper or as large as climate change. And he said the tendency is to wait for they or them to solve the problem. Older people, political figures, businessmen. And he'd look at me and say, "Son, you could wait forever. The they is you. You are the they." So that's the perspective that we all want to have in life, and especially athletes.
Yeah. It's just an incredible amount that, you know, you've given back, not only to the aging community, the sports community, but overall. I mean, that's unheard of level of, you know, giving and everything that you have, and I think a lot of your clients, I would guess, would attribute a lot of that to you, and they may not have done that if it weren't for you. So it's an incredible story and a great place to end on. And again, the foundation, LeeSteinbergFoundation.org, is going to be incredible, not only for concussions, but all the other things that we've talked about, which sounds really, really exciting.
I mean, the most incredible contribution is how you raise your kid. Market Scale has a great fortune of having the apple of my eye, Katie, working here, who's a ball of fire.
She is. She's incredible. You're exactly right. The greatest testament to a parent is their children, and Katie is incredible. I've had the pleasure of working with her as well. And I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. This has been incredible, and I think it's really important for business leaders to be able to see examples of the integrity paying off, and someone that's as successful as you that has had the career that you've had, but you've done it the right way. And it was always about integrity and about doing things the right way. And I think it's really important that we continue to show as many examples of people like you that have done it the right way, that you don't have to take a shortcut you don't have to compromise your principles. You can stay true to what you do, and you just give it time and keep doing things the right way, that it's going to pay off.
Well, thank you. I now have the illustrious experience of Crow Nose to add to my resume. I would treasure it.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Lee Steinberg, again, go check out the foundation, Agent Academy. Anything that you guys can do to help, we'll make sure that we link in the show notes and have it on the website as well. So again, it's another episode of the Crow Nose Podcast, sponsored by OPW Commercial Services. Lee, thank you so much.
You're welcome.